You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I'm Mark Feinsand, executive reporter for MLB.com. Welcome to the Executive Access Podcast. Ned Rice grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. as a fan of the Baltimore Orioles, taking trips to watch games at Camden Yards. After graduating from William & Mary, he joined the Orioles in the media relations department, starting a career in baseball that has seen him move up the front office ranks. Rice remained in Baltimore through three different front office regimes before moving to Philadelphia in 2016 to become the Phillies' assistant general manager. I had a chance to sit down with Rice at the Phillies' spring facility in Clearwater, Florida, before camps shut down due to the coronavirus pandemic. We discussed his start with the Orioles, what he's learned working for Andy McPhail, the pros to bringing so-called non-baseball people into a front office, the highs and lows of pursuing high-profile free agents like Manny Machado and Bryce Harper, and much more. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Phillies' assistant general manager, Ned Rice. But first, let's hear a word from this week's sponsor. Putting ketchup on a Chicago dog? That's a bad choice. Playing Yahoo Fantasy Baseball, the official fantasy game of MLB? That's a good choice. It's free to play, easy to use, and there are flexible season lengths, meaning you can start or stop whenever you want. Yahoo was also rated the number one fantasy app for users by the FSGA in 2019, unanimously chosen. So make better choices. Choose Yahoo Fantasy Baseball. Ned, you grew up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. There were no Nationals at the time, right?
Yeah.
Who was your favorite team?
I was an Orioles fan. I think that makes sense. I think most of my friends were. So I grew up going to Camden Yards all the time, and the traffic was terrible, but you'd gut it out and get through there. But, I mean, again, the Orioles were big in D.C. when I was a kid. I mean, the Washington Post covered them. That was the baseball team for D.C. When I was there. So it's a lot of fun, and I have a lot of memories of going to playoff games there in 96 and 97, and so getting to eventually work for them was really special.
So Jeffrey Mayer, not a good name for you.
Not a great name. I remember where I was for that, too. Yeah,
I think that was the first playoff game I ever went to.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's crazy.
I was a New Yorker, so yeah. We were on the right side of that one at the time. But
that was exciting. You get the right field umpire right out there. And
right.
It's like, that's why we have umpires down the line.
That's right. What was your peak as a baseball player?
I was not much of a baseball player. This is going to sound like an excuse, but I was a pretty good player in Little League, and I played baseball and basketball, and I kind of pretty quickly got bad at baseball and stayed pretty good at basketball, and so I stopped playing baseball, and I found out like a year later I just had terrible vision, and so that didn't really impact you as much playing basketball as it would playing baseball. So then I missed it. You miss a year of playing, everybody else gets better, and you're just like, I can't get back in now, so I just focused on basketball. So now that having the career I have, I wish I had just got, who cares, it's 1 year, you would have been fine. But it was fun. I love playing basketball. I still love basketball. I don't have the high-level playing experience that a lot of my colleagues do.
You graduated from the College of William & Mary in 2005 with a major in government. Was a career in baseball always the goal?
No. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I actually thought some kind of government or politics would be interesting. I did a lot of student government in college, which was a great experience, just learning how to work with different people and handle things like that. But no, I didn't really know. I think it was sort of towards the end of my time in college, I had a friend whose friend worked as a PR intern for the Orioles, and I was like, that sounds amazing. Like, I think like a lot of people my age, you read Moneyball, and you're like, I'm kind of mathematically inclined. And you're like, this, you can apply this stuff to it. This could be a real job, and you never really thought of that before. So I wouldn't say it was until like, maybe junior or even maybe senior year of college where you're like, that'd be really cool, but you don't really know if it's going to work out. So my best connection was somebody who worked in PR at the Nationals, and so I went up and I met him, and he was great, and his name was Lars, and he offered me eventually an internship, and I was like, this is great. So right when I graduated, I'm going to start in PR with the Nationals, and so I call him right when times, and they let him go, which was like, because the Nationals at that point were kind of making a lot of changes. They let him go, and he's like, I don't really, like, I was kind of your guy. I'm not sure. So I tried to call them, and they said, we're still about. So I kind of, that was the big opportunity I thought I had, disappeared. So I was pretty bummed about that. But eventually, through kind of another person, I found out that the PR, one of the assistants in PR, Monica Pence at the time, was also a William & Mary grad. So I reached out to her and got an interview there and did an unpaid fall internship in the fall of 2005. So I was living at my parents' place and kind of driving an hour and a half each way. But it was just unbelievable. Like, I still kind of think about, like, the first time you walk into the warehouse where you come to games forever as a fan, it just felt like the most special thing in the world. It's pretty neat, like, having your first job at the team you grew up loving.
You shifted from media relations to baseball ops in 2006, started as an intern like so many others. You were also the road video coordinator that year.
You prepared.
What was that first experience in baseball ops like for you?
Yeah, so I knew I was going to start a baseball ops internship on opening day. I'd done a couple fall and spring in PR, and had my kind of big break was as the PR intern, you bring the press clips around. So you're used to, now it's all electronic, but it was a really cool experience. So I'd cut them all out, tape them, Xerox them, and bring the packets around. So you get all the baseball ops executives, you get them, so you kind of get to know everybody and kind of put a face to name in a way that you might not get to now. So that enabled me to get that first internship. And then, like, maybe 2 weeks before I was supposed to start it, they said, the guy who runs our stadium video operation said the video coordinator just had a baby and doesn't want to do the road games. Can you fill in and do that? We just need somebody who can do it and is available on short notice. And no one's more available on short notice than a 22-year-old single guy. So I said, yeah. So I was doing I was in the office during the home games, and I was on the road in every road game. And talk about, like, an amazing experience as a young guy. It's like, who again, without a lot of background in this, you're on the road, you're in a big league clubhouse, you're seeing how stuff really works, how coaching staffs prepare, how players really are. And I think for a lot of us that kind of grow up reading Baseball Prospectus or Fangraphs or whatever, and kind of seeing this is how, you know, all these teams are doing these things wrong and we should do it differently, and you kind of have this certain idea of how you'd want to fix things if you were in charge, it was good to really see how things actually worked and, like, what went into it. And these are real people, and people are trying their best, and there's a reason they do different things. So it was awesome getting, and again, also you're traveling, you're doing charter flights and these nice hotels when you have,
right, living a life that, yeah, most 22-year-old right, single guys don't.
Yeah, you're making $7 an hour, but you're living the same life on the road that these millionaires are. It's crazy. Yeah, so it was a great experience.
That first year, you talked about being able to interact and put a face to names and stuff. Yeah. Mike Flanagan and Jim Duquette were running the team that year. How much interaction did you have with them in those early days?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, the other thing is that at that time, overall in baseball, and I think Baltimore specifically, we had smaller front offices. So now the intern might not get to know the GM, but just when you're there, you know, whatever, 60 hours a week, including on the road, 80, 90 hours a week, you run into these people all the time. So I kind of sat at not a cubicle, but just sort of at this, like, desk out in the hallway, which is right outside their offices. So you'd see them multiple times a day. It was cool. So I think as time went on, you'd kind of try to pick your spots and give, you know, you'd see a topic that you thought maybe the organization could use a little more input on. You would try to very carefully and respectfully word something and give it to him, and you'd be nervous about, you know, what's Jim going to think? And then he'd say, hey, that was good. Well, can you write me something up on this? So kind of over time, got more opportunities, and they were both great to me. And Jim's still someone I'd consider a friend to this day. And obviously Mike's situation is really tragic, but they were really great. And I think either one of them could have just said, "Hey, you just leave us alone." And they were always they were really cool with me.
2007, you're promoted to player information analyst, a role you held for 4 years. What were your responsibilities there?
Yeah, so that was the other thing. So when Andy McPhail gets hired to be the GM of the Orioles, our administrative assistant for the GM was sick, and they needed someone just to answer Andy's phone. And again, this is still, cell phones are just kind of becoming on, but, like, most GMs are calling each other on their landline.
So those are flip phones back then, right? They weren't even iPhones or anything.
No, yet. I don't think so.
Maybe,
yeah,
a BlackBerry.
Like, maybe in 07. But, like, you know, I think if GM wanted to call Andy to talk a trade, he was calling his office line. So, like, I was sitting out there answering his phone. So when you're there, you're kind of really understanding what happens in a day. Like, okay, he's doing this. And then you kind of get to learn what the GM's schedule is. And same sort of thing, where I think I was probably our most sabermetrically inclined front office person at that time, just by the nature of being young and a little mathematical. So I would kind of pick spots to give Andy recommendations on things. And again, this is very minor stuff compared to what you know people do now. But I think he found it helpful a little bit. So eventually he offered me, that was my first full-time job, was he wanted to kind of formalize that and and add some kind of this analysis into all of our transactions. And it was just, again, it was an awesome opportunity. It's a small front office. As a young guy, you're getting involved in everything we're doing. A team calls and wants to talk trades. Like, what name should we be looking at? And you're kind of pulling together scouting reports and statistical stuff. It's just, somebody now couldn't have that same experience. We're just so much more sophisticated and bigger and have, frankly, smarter people. But it was an unbelievable time.
Andy once said, this is one of my favorite quotes, "I used to make poor Ned Rice in Baltimore come up and explain everything to me. I would say, what about this nonsense? And he would explain to me that I was old and dumb and needed to understand these things." I'm guessing you never actually used the words old and dumb.
You're correct.
But did you see a shift at the time as a young guy in the game? Could you see a shift sort of happening between old school and new school?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think at the beginning it could be more contentious. So I think like how you went about stuff was really important. It's something that Andy gave me a lot of good feedback on at the beginning. But I've always tried to understand somebody else's perspective and why they feel the way they do, why they operate the way they do. You know, you have a lot of people that, you know, the sabermetric community saying this guy's dumb, he's doing this wrong, and here he's won, you know, 1,500 games as a manager in the big leagues. It's like, what? I mean, this guy probably doesn't think he's dumb. He's had a lot of success without you or you or you. So,
right.
Andy's like that too. I mean, Andy's a guy who had 2 World Series wins, been a GM, he's now in his third place. He'd run an organization, and he's had a ton of success, but he was still always curious and always wanted to know more and was open-minded, and he would push back on things that he didn't think made sense. But, he was always respectful about it, always curious. I mean, you couldn't work for a better guy. Again, just an incredibly lucky first opportunity.
Andy's career is very well-known, legendary. Anybody who hasn't heard his episode on this podcast should go find it because it's fascinating stuff. What was your biggest takeaway working for him in Baltimore?
Oh, man. He's still like this now. Obviously, I work for him here, too. He is, I think, more than anybody I've worked with, understands the bigger picture very well. So he in whatever you're doing, he can see, he sees the whole playing field, what this is going to mean. You know, if we're talking about something that's bargaining related, he'll understand what this will mean to the union and what it'll mean to the league. And he's obviously got a lot of experience doing that. He'll understand when we're doing changes in the minor leagues, what this will mean to the players, what it'll mean to the coaches. You know, I think there's a lot of times where I would have an idea that I really thought made a lot of sense. I'd run it through a few different ways. He'd come in, he's like, yeah, you know, I get where you're coming from, but for this and this reason, I don't think that makes sense. I'd be like, I'd never thought of that. You know, he just sees the whole playing field really well.
2012, Dan Duquette gets hired as the GM in Baltimore. You're named assistant director of Major League Operations. This is your third front office regime in a fairly brief career to that point. What's it like to make that transition when somebody new comes in to run the baseball ops department?
Yeah, I mean, you have to be flexible and adjustable. I mean, like Dan, like Jim Duquette and Mike Flanagan sort of brought me in as an intern, and Andy, when he hired me, decided he wanted me to be, you know, make me full-time and expand my role. Dan never hired me, so he didn't have any obligation to me or you know, so it's a little scary at a time, right? You're not sure, he might have his own guy or not really want to include you. But Dan was always great too. We had, you know, obviously that was, we got, Buck was hired just before that, and I had a good relationship with him. So I think kind of my role shifted a little bit in that Dan did have people he probably got more analysis from. So I did less of that, and I spent more time around our major league team, more time managing the day-to-day roster, stuff with salary, payroll, a lot of the stuff Matt Klentak did before he left. So I got a lot of opportunities to do different things than I'd been doing before. So I was kind of did less analysis and more stuff that's kind of, it's similar to what I do now, and kind of more an assistant GM type role, even though, you know, that wasn't the title. I was doing a lot of stuff that just managed our day-to-day 25-man operations. You know, that was a great experience too. Dan's first year, we made the playoffs, got in the wild card. There's just, every day was different. We were juggling rosters left and right like crazy. We thought we were a little short talent-wise compared to some of the teams we were competing with, and that we had to always be churning and making sure we had the best guys for that day. So that was like, every day was kind of a puzzle post-game, and working with Dan and Buck was awesome.
That, you mentioned you guys made the playoffs that year. They hadn't been in the playoffs since those games you were talking about going to as a fan.
Yeah.
What was it like to be a part of that? And did you feel like the organization at the time was sort of headed for a lengthy run?
It's hard to say. I mean, I think you go back then, you remember that, Boston and New York were both good, and they had money and talent, and you just felt like they were going to be good forever. It felt a little insurmountable. I think we felt really good about some of the young talent we had, both through the draft and some of the trades we had, like trading Bedard and Tejada brought us a lot of interesting players. But you don't really know. I think the Hardy trade was important for us, and we never really had a shortstop. That solidified things. You know, I'm trying to think back, but I think the whole time in 2012, you kind of felt like it was a little bit of a pinch me moment the whole time. You just never really thought it was going to work out, and we're right there, and you know, hopefully we can still be playing meaningful games in September. And you get to September, oh my God, it might be able, you know, and you think you're going to do it. I remember the thing then is Baltimore. It was such a good baseball town, and they just had nothing to root for a long time. And they really started coming in September, and the games were, we were selling out some games against the Yankees during the week, which was so cool, and the place was rocking. And we really wanted to have a home playoff game and see what that experience would be like. But you have to, with the wild card games on the road in Texas, we had Joe Saunders starting against Yu Darvish, and that was sort of our formula all year long. We never really had, we had a great bullpen, and we scored some runs, and we played great defense, but. I don't know what the Vegas odds would have been on that matchup, but you know, I think we certainly felt we were underdogs, and you go in there and win, and just how excited everybody was, and to get to the home games and play in Baltimore was just unbelievable.
I was still in the Yankees beat back then. I remember going into Camden Yards that September,
yeah,
and it was, you hadn't seen the ballpark like that.
Yeah.
You know, I've been covering the Yankees for 12 years at that point.
It's nothing like
the Orioles had not been. You know what was yeah. going on that season, and it was really cool to see Camden Yards sort of. Energized again, yeah. and the playoffs were great. Yeah, it was a really.
And I remember that was the year because they just changed the format so that the first two games were at the lower seed. So
right.
Even though the Yankees were the high seed, we opened game one at home, and we had gave up a bunch of runs in the ninth inning to lose, but came back and won game two. I mean, the whole series was great back and forth. You had we talked about it a lot with Joe when we were hiring him, but that's when. He pinch hits
Ibanez for A-Rod. Yep. I vaguely remember that.
Yeah. And you know, that was one thing we talked to Joe about in the interview. It was like, how, you know, what a tough decision for a manager, and like how, like what goes into that. You pitch it, you know, so
right.
So, but it was more interesting to talk about now than it was to live at the time.
I'm sure. I remember talking to Bob Miller on this podcast, and he was talking about rules and how when he was a young guy coming up. Somebody said to him, if you know the rules, you'll always have a job, and how important it is to know every loophole, every rule, and everything else. In 2014, you found a loophole that allowed the Orioles to keep Steve Pierce, or bring back Steve Pierce after the team had DFA'd him. He had been claimed by the Blue Jays. How important is it to know every one of these rules so that when something like this comes up, you have a chance to take advantage of that?
It's important. I mean, I'll admit, I didn't know that one before we used it.
Tell us what that was.
So we had designated Pierce for assignment, and then so that buys you at that time you get 10 days to resolve a situation. So you can, by the end of 10 days, you have to either put him on waivers, release him, or trade him. We knew he was good enough that he'd get claimed on waivers, so all three of those result in him leaving our franchise. So there's kind of no way out of that. The next day, Chris Davis gets hurt, and now we're like, well, you know, we didn't really have a role for Pierce because we had people start, but now we don't really have a backup first baseman. So Davis, we were very lucky the timing of this. Davis gets hurt and is going to be a 15-day DL stint. We're like, man, we'd love to have Pierce back, but is there any way to do it? So we're kind of going through, assuming the answer is no. This you kind of go on these searches a lot. Is there any way we can figure, you know, usually the answer is no. But for some reason, there's a rule that if you release a player, you can't re-sign him for 30 days. And the loophole there was unless you are playing short from the time of that you release him until he clears his release waivers, which is 48 hours. So we kind of looked at it, and we had a game, and then we had an off day. So we were like, if we can just, we can put Chris Davis on the DL, go to 24, not call anybody up for him, put Pierce on waivers, then you have the off day, he'll clear the next day, then we could sign him back and put him right back in the big leagues. And I don't really know why that rule exists. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. But when we kind of found that, you know, you check with the league. Are we reading this right? Like, this seems crazy.
I want to make sure I'm reading this correctly.
And then so it worked out, and Steve was great, and his agent was great. They were excited to come back and go right into everyday playing time. And then he took off. So even when Davis came back, we had to keep his bat in the lineup. He was playing so well. He ended up with, like, a, you know, 4-win season, mostly playing left field for us, and did an awesome job. He's a great kid. So that was a cool story. Yeah, I think it's important to know the rules. There's a lot of times where if you kind of know how, if you know things intuitively, you've been through them before, you can maybe anticipate a situation. But also, there's a lot of help for you. Like the when Matt Klentak left to be the assistant GM of the Angels, I kind of became a rules guy and didn't know any of the rules. So I tried to learn them, but I would call the league 3 times a day. Hey, we're gonna do this, and then we're gonna do this. Is that allowed? yeah, that's allowed.
You're fine. How many times were you told, no, that's not allowed?
Not too often, but you check, and they're good too. They kind of know who's new, and they keep an eye on you.
Right.
And say, hey, we got this deadline coming up next week. So, I'd call Matt anytime I didn't know about something. So I had a lot of support, which was helpful learning something new.
January 2016, you're hired by the Phillies as assistant general manager. You'd been with the Orioles a long time, your hometown area, sort of.
Yeah.
Given your relationship with Matt, was it an easy decision to come to Philly?
Yeah, professionally I thought it was. I mean, the thing is I had just gotten engaged, so that, you know, you have to make sure this now becomes a family decision as opposed to just a personal decision. And my wife's an attorney and was so her job was flexible and then she could go somewhere else, but she was awesome and thought a new adventure sounded fun. And the other thing I tell people this now is like when you don't really hear, I live in DC my whole life in Baltimore, you don't really hear like a lot of great things about Philly as a city. And I was like, you know, that'll be a great job. I don't know if I want to live in Philly, but you know, the job will be worth it and we'll just kind of deal with the Philly part. And we get there and we like love it. And it's just, we live in the city and people said, you're going to want to move to the suburbs. And we rented in the city and we just bought a house in the city. And, you know, it's amazing. We're raising our kid there now, and just we think it's, so it worked out better than we could have ever anticipated. It's just kind of a sleeper great town. It's kind of, you know, you hear all about New York and D.C. So that's great. We're still sort of close to family. But professionally, it's been amazing. Matt is great to work with. We maintained a strong relationship after he left for the Angels. And it was just a great opportunity to be more involved in the global, you know, the running of a department. We were starting a rebuild fairly from scratch, so we were really trying to build an organization up from the ground floor, and that was really appealing to me. Is like we were kind of, as opposed to kind of continuing in Baltimore where we'd gotten to that point, is start over and try to build something up that could be sustainably successful was the goal.
New organization brings some new challenges, I'm sure, learning the whole system and sort of learning the way things operate. Having Andy, having Matt, another assistant GM, Scott Profrock, and player development director, Joe Jordan, also guys you were familiar with. How much did that familiarity sort of ease your transition into not only a new work environment, but a new city and just sort of a whole change in life?
It helped a ton. Yeah, Scott was with me at the Orioles. He was assistant GM when you mentioned I first got hired by Mike and Jim. Scott was, I think, probably the first person I interviewed with. Scott has always been really supportive to me throughout my career and still is. Joe I knew pretty well, Matt and Andy, so that made it easy. And you've probably heard this before. It sounds like everything I'm saying is just so rosy positive, but I've been pretty lucky. The Phillies are just an insanely family-friendly, welcoming organization. I assume you've heard that from other people before, but they go out of their way to welcome people, to make, you know, whether you're an intern or assistant GM, everybody knows, and it's talked about that. Kind of started with David Montgomery, and you know, my first day he came over and sat down and ate lunch with me and wanted to know everything about, you know, my background, and he already knew a lot. He was prepared like you were, but you know, wanted to know what my wife does and where she's working in the city and where we're going to be living, and this is the guy who's the longtime president, everybody said should be the commissioner of baseball.
Right.
And the thing is, that wasn't unique to me or because I was just, he does that with every intern on their first day. And you know, I'm definitely a strong believer that a culture of a place starts at the top, you know, and between him and our ownership groups. There's just so many opportunities when you run a club or when you run any business, like, you know, I'm sure same thing for you, that you're the people who run it have so many different decisions over the course of the day that can either be pro-employee or anti-employee, can either like antagonize the people that work for them or make them feel like supported. And they, like our group will kind of spare no expense to make people feel supported. And I think that's fairly unique in baseball. I'm sure there are other great places to work, but this is pretty special.
You mentioned some of the things you were responsible for, your media guide bio, says your job description includes mapping out strategy of roster management, overseeing the analytic and medical departments, assisting in player contracts, negotiations, transactions, salary arbitration, and rules compliance. It's a lot of stuff.
A lot of fluff.
A lot of stuff in there. Scouting report time. What area do you believe is your greatest strength?
That's a fair question. I think probably is just interacting with people fairly well. I feel like I can get along with people of all different backgrounds. I feel like with older school managers, coaches, scouts, or our analytics team, trainers. I think part of this is background growing up. A lot of it's working with Andy and seeing how he does it. I feel like I have a pretty good ability to, when there's ever kind of a conflict or something between two departments or two people or inside versus outside, just to understand a little bit where each side's coming from and try to mediate that a little bit. A lot of what we do is probably more boring compared to what people might view from the outside, because there's a lot of cool things when you're signing Bryce Harper or whatever. There's a lot of fascinating things that come with the job. But a lot of it is, Matt is sort of, as the GM, in charge of a baseball operations group that has, 200 plus employees, 200 plus players. You're kind of running a small little company within your company. And just like anything, just a lot of stuff comes up. And, I know I talk to my wife a lot, that there are a lot of days you come home and she's like, "What'd you do today?" And I'm like, "I don't know, but I was like busy all day." And like, "What are you doing tomorrow?" I'm like, "I'm not sure, but like it's..."
But I know I won't have any time to breathe.
It's not going to be, not that you never have some slower days, but every day is a little different. I think you're putting out fires more than I would have guessed coming in. You're just dealing with, okay, what's the issue of today and fixing that. So I try to be adaptable, but big picture, I think there's a lot of people that would be good at these jobs. I know I think we're all replaceable to a degree, and we hire more and more like really impressive people, all the time. There's more, you're hiring people that played baseball at a high level that have advanced degrees and just really have unbelievable skill sets. And it's unbelievable how smart and impressive the game has become. As you probably know better than anybody from doing all these.
Yes, there have been plenty of people who I have on this podcast who are far, far brighter than me. But fortunately, I can just read a list of questions and have a conversation.
That's why you wanted to do this one?
So even the best players in the game have areas of their game they want to improve upon, and they work to do that. What area of your game, so to speak, would you want to improve upon most?
So my biggest regret is, you asked if I wanted to do this for a long time, and I think the best evidence that I did not is that I took French growing up, in high school, which is just completely useless. So like I'd love to speak Spanish better. There's certain things that I wish I was better at that I'm not sure what the capacity for would be. I mean, I think I didn't play baseball at a high level. I think there are certain things you can learn from. Being around it, I feel like I'm comfortable in discussions with scouts and such, but like I don't see the game the way a scout sees the game, and so I think some of that is stuff where if I dove in on that, I could probably get better, and some of it is, I think there's a certain experience you get from playing the game at this level or a level close to it that just is a differentiator. But I think those are probably the two things I wish I had more. I wish I spoke Spanish. I wish I had more higher level playing experience.
I'm right there with you on the Spanish front. I took Spanish in high school. I just didn't do well in it, and I wish I'd paid more attention, because if I had known what career I was going to get into, that would have been...
Imagine how versatile that'd be.
Right?
Get interviews.
Mariano Rivera used to joke with me. He would always speak to me in Spanish and then say, "How many words did you understand?" I'd say, "I understand like every third word or so." He tried, but I don't know.
You know enough Spanish where if you're walking through the clubhouse and you feel like they're talking about you, you can tell what they're saying?
No.
No, I don't. Okay, so they can say whatever they want.
Yeah, pretty much. In March of 2017, the Phillies, who had been considered kind of behind other clubs on the analytic front, invested a lot of money in the department. You guys brought in people with resumes all over the place. Google, Northrop Grumman, Bank of America, Baseball Prospectus, sort of very big variety of people. You said at the time that bringing in people from outside the game was appealing because they come in with no assumptions. Why was it important to you to have such a wide variety of people from different places to come in to work in a baseball analytics department?
Yeah, I think as much as we like all pride ourselves in baseball on being creative and open-minded, and you know, we read Moneyball and then we read this and everything's, we're going to analyze it. I think there's still, even though that's sort of advanced thinking on some levels, it's also we all were kind of reading the same advanced thinking, you know, if you will. So I think we, a lot of the people who were in baseball at that were considered kind of new school, we all sort of learned and thought the game similarly. And I think there's a lot of good stuff in there, but it's, we still thought it'd be easy to get groupthinky about that. And so I think new people that are really smart and can just address these, address problems without preconceived notions is appealing. And sometimes, you know, we'll work through something with our R&D group and they'll suggest something that really just doesn't make a lot of sense for whatever reason. Sometimes they will come up with something that hadn't really occurred to us before. So, I think you need some kind of a balance, and we have a lot of that now. We have a lot of people that work heavily with our R&D group that have playing experience and time on the field, but they've been great. They're a lot of fun to work with.
The group thinky thing is interesting because it's sort of like you kind of have to some extent, do what everybody else is doing, because if there's something there that's beneficial, you can't fall behind there, but at the same time, you're trying to be innovative in your own right.
Right.
So it's a
tough needle to thread. I think you know, one of these days you should get Sam Fold on this, but Sam's really impressive in that area. I think he's as progressive and smart as any analyst, you know, in the game. But he has unbelievable feel for players. So we'll sometimes be looking, you know, there's a certain adjustment we want a player to make because you can see statistically he's much better doing this than that. And Sam will usually agree and try to help implement it. And sometimes he'll be like, you know, for this and this reason, I don't think that's going to work for him. And you're like, wow, that's a great point. So, it's important to have a lot of people, a lot of diverse approaches, and people who think about the game in different ways. I think it's just going to make you better and increase the chances that the best ideas will win the day.
What does the word analytics mean to you? Because if you think about it, the word's evolved a lot over the last two decades, right? We think back to Moneyball. That was sort of the beginning of the analytics boom. It was on base percentage, really, right? Yeah. Now, obviously, it's a lot deeper. It's not necessarily stats, metrics. It's sort of a very wide-ranging word at this point, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was kind of inevitable that this would eventually happen in baseball. You know, when you look back, it's what has happened to every company and the world is that as data, you know, they talk about big data, as you have more information, companies are going to use it to try to get competitive advantages. So, but there's all kinds of information that fits within analytics. Like you mentioned stats and I think that's what we commonly think of analytics as, but like a lot of their projects involve, you know, what are the most predictive elements of our scouting reports, and like what things are our scouts really, really good at predicting, and maybe they predict better than traditional stats would. What medically, like what types of things that we see in college become issues as you become progress further along. So I think there's all sorts of different data sources, but it's not just statistics. It's everything we use to evaluate players and like how to balance everything the most properly to make the best decision. If that to sum up in a sentence.
Sure. So, summer of 2018, you guys were one of the teams that had pretty extensive talks with the Orioles when Machado was on the block. A lot of executives, a lot of front offices are loath to give up prospects for a rental.
Yeah.
How tough is it to balance long-term interest versus short-term interest when you think you have a chance to go for it when an opportunity presents itself at that time of year? I mean, the one everybody always points to is the Cubs trading Gleyber Torres for Aroldis Chapman, which obviously in the long run is not a good trade for... But they won the World Series that year, and Chapman was a big part of it. So, you know, Theo Epstein has said, I knew that was going to hurt, but I wouldn't undo it because he helped us win the World Series.
We had, when I was at the Orioles in 2014, when we won the AL East, at the deadline, our bullpen was a little shaky. We really needed someone on the left side. Best guy out there was Andrew Miller, who's obviously just dominant wipeout guy. And the price was going to be Eduardo Rodriguez, who... You know, so as, again, I think this is an interesting learning perspective where I was fairly opposed to doing it, and you know, Dan didn't want to do it, but it was at a certain point was like, you know, this is, who knows if you have another chance like this. This is a pretty good team. We owe it to the team. So we do the trade. The team that would have had him, you know, by kind of news reports came out as the runners-up were the Tigers with Dombrowski. So we played the Tigers in the first round of the division series, and we largely beat them in their bullpen. And our bullpen was lights out, and I remember kind of thinking that I admire Dan's kind of guts there. I think it'd be easy to just say, this is a bad long-term play, we're going to build for the future, but you don't really know what the future will be, and you know. So anyway, rambling point, but I think you're exactly right. That season we had a pretty good team that we thought that would be a hole that Mandy could fill a hole for us really well at a superstar level. So we were willing to go a little further then. And then when that didn't come to fruition, we weren't like, well, we're going all in on somebody else. We then had a pretty conservative trade deadline. I think we thought that. That he was a pretty unique situation. There's not usually superstar rental players available, and we thought he could really push us over the edge. So we made a pretty significant offer that I think was similar in value to what he ended up going for, and they picked the other offer. But it's uncomfortable. Yeah, I mean, I think it's very easy when you're the GM. I'm sure you've talked to a lot of GMs. I think a lot of times when you're debating a trade, everybody kind of thinks, what's the worst case scenario that could happen here? It's like, I trade this guy, he becomes amazing. This becomes the whoever trade, whatever the prospect name is that it's known as forever. So I think we try to fight just risk aversion by default, but I think there's a certain risk aversion that's baked into every GM a little bit. And maybe except for Jerry, which I also admire about him. So yeah, it's hard. And we have that debate. I mean, we have that debate now. I mean, we read all the time that the Phillies need one more piece and they should trade Bryant. And we talk to teams. We're always trying to get better, but there's a certain price that you think is too far, and you won't know for a number of years if you were right or not.
After the 2018 season, you were under consideration for the lead baseball ops job in Baltimore. Knowing your history with that organization, rooting for them as a kid, what was that process like for you?
Really cool. It was a great experience. I had good relationship with both John and Lou Angelos. They were conducting the search. I kind of told them at the outset that I didn't think I'd want to do it just because we were just starting a family in Philly. I was so happy there. I was really excited about the trajectory we're on. But I had a lot of thoughts about the organization and think like the direction they should go for my time there. Spent a lot of time there and then juxtaposed it with some of the things in Philly. And I think there were a lot of things that the Orioles did really well and a lot of things I thought they could do better. And I was excited to talk about it. I still care about that organization. I mean, they gave me my start. It's who I grew up rooting for. So I was excited to sit down with them. They were awesome. They had a ton of questions and were very interested. And again, I think it would have been, I think it would have been a tough time for me to go do something else, but they obviously found someone awesome in Mike, who I went to high school with.
That was my next question. Yeah. When you're researching these things for these podcasts, and all of a sudden you see something, you're like, is that right? So you and Mike Elias were high school classmates back home in Virginia. Yeah. Are you ever sort of amazed at how small this baseball world is?
It's crazy. It was a small, I was a graduating class of 400 or something. We were in the same class. I think we weren't like best friends, but in a small school, you kind of know everybody fairly well. So, I think we've stayed in touch a little bit as each of us kind of moved on to different jobs. And obviously, he had a lot of success with Houston, which I was really excited for him about. So, it's amazing. Small world for sure.
January of 2019, you and the rest of the front office meet with both Manny Machado and Bryce Harper. They're the two biggest free agents on the market. We obviously know in hindsight now how that turned out. But how much fun was it, or was it stressful? How was it to be engaged with the two biggest players on the market, knowing that your team had the ability to sign one of them? I mean, there are a lot of teams out there that don't even take meetings with players like that because they know that they can't play in that ballpark.
Yeah, no, you were right. The whole thing was a pretty surreal experience, and I knew Manny pretty well, and I didn't know Bryce at all, and so we did Manny first, and we had him in. He was great, and getting to spend time with him and his wife and his agent, and we had a whole long day. We had a dinner that was amazing. We had a blast, so that was great. And I think we both left there feeling good about each other, and obviously the economics didn't quite line up, And then Harper was amazing too. Again, as a guy I didn't know at all, and you have, I think everybody in the league has certain preconceived notions of who he is from watching him play. And so we met with him for about 4 hours in Las Vegas, and just like the most thoughtful. He's a baseball historian. I mean, have you spent much time with him?
Not a whole lot, a little bit.
He was reciting to John some, John would mention a moment, that he was important to him at the Phillies from, maybe the 2009 NLCS, and Bryce would finish his sentence because he knows the play he's talking about. I mean, there's not a lot of guys that are like that today,
right?
Where Bryce loves baseball. So I think that was incredible to get to know him and see what he's like. But then you still wonder a little bit, like, is he's trying to get signed? Is this what he's really like? And I'm kind of going off topic here, but he has been like the best teammate, the best guy, the best partner. We're very lucky. When you make a commitment of 13 years, it's pretty scary. Like, you're like, what if, month two in May, you're like, man, this guy's kind of a jerk. Like, what are we
going right.
You got 12 and a half more years to play this out. So, the team leader, he's been awesome. But yeah, it's a crazy experience, and that's something I don't think ever would have happened in Baltimore. For instance, if I say they're not just—I know they've made a lot of significant commitments, but it's—I think there's only a handful of teams that can be in on meetings with Bryce Harper at the $300 million level, and we're lucky to have a pretty supportive ownership group.
Ironically, you guys signed the player that you didn't know.
Yeah.
But when generally speaking, when you are courting a free agent or you're thinking about a player in a trade, is it beneficial to have had that prior relationship with the player and know, you took a meeting with Manny Machado, you knew Manny Machado, Matt knew Manny Machado, Andy McPhailey, Manny Machado, and the good and the bad and in between and everything else. Is it, everybody always talks about doing their homework and due diligence on their makeup and then what they're going to be like at the clubhouse and all that. You know what they can do on the field. Is that an advantage when you know the player?
A little bit. Andy and Matt didn't really know Manny that well, in that he debuted sort of after they had both left. He was there as a minor league player, but it's hard to get to know those guys really well. I knew Manny, but even when I knew, was kind of old by the time we got there, right? So, like, my last year with them was in 2015, and we're doing this before the 2019 season. So it's 16, 17, 18, where he's a superstar and getting the attention and the free, I'm sure you've seen a lot of players can and often are different at, as a 2-year player and as a 6-year player. So we still did, I think, an extensive amount of homework on both those guys. And, obviously I knew a lot of people at the Orioles, so that helped a lot.
Right.
And I was able to talk to a lot of people about what's he like, how's he changed, this and that, and make sure we have a comfort level with him. And Bryce, who we knew less about, but we have people here who worked with Bryce. Brian Minitti spent a lot of time with him, Eric Dalton, one of our scouts. We have people who know him pretty well. But we still called, dozens of people that worked with him in other capacities that we know in the industry. It's just, I think it'd be foolish not to.
Of course.
It's just, I think, and you're never going to get like a perfectly consistent picture, but if you talk to 30 people and you're getting hearing something from 25, 26, like you start to feel pretty good that that's probably what you're getting.
So after you've gone through this whole process and then Bryce agrees to sign with the Phillies, what's the feeling? Is it?
Yeah.
Relief? Is it euphoria? Is it like, oh my God, I can't believe this actually got done?
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. Everybody, you've seen everybody in Philly was going nuts. We were down here. There's some relief. It just took a while. I think it was probably February 28th or 7th or something. It was right at the end of February, start of March last year. So you're in spring training where usually you're getting ready for the next year, and we're spending the whole time, it's like, all day, every day on the Bryce stuff. And so there's some relief that you could turn the page, but just excitement and just what it means. And I think when you start a rebuild, you're kind of hoping that eventually get to the point of sustained competitiveness. And but bringing it, like knowing that you're the kind of the team and the franchise you guys that exist is attractive to the, maybe premier free agent of all time so far, I think that's rewarding. Obviously, money is a huge aspect of it, but I don't think he wanted to sign somewhere where he thought, this is not a good place for me or my family, or if it's somewhere that I don't think they're going to be able to be competitive. So I think it said a lot about the organization, both baseball-wise and the ownership family atmosphere here, that he wanted to play with the Phillies.
You guys went through a managerial search this past offseason, ultimately hired Joe Girardi, who I have spent a lot of time around. I've heard some executives say that they dread manager searches, that they're just tedious and long and you just want to get somebody hired. I've heard other people say it's a great opportunity to gain insight into the way others think and organizations they've been around, etc. Yeah. How did you view how do you view the process of a managerial search?
I think those are both completely correct. I think our two manager searches are two of the more interesting things we've done, but it is hard because the off season is only so long, and the manager search, because of how important it is takes forever. It's like when we did the first one where we hired Cap, it's probably all day every day for 2.5 weeks. You know, you're doing first round, our first round interview with 7 or 8 guys is 8 hours and a dinner. You know, so it's crazy. But you're meeting such fascinating people that have been through experiences that you can't quite always relate to, and you're trying to picture which of these different skill sets will fit best into your market and your team. It's a really fascinating experience. I had a great time with both of them. And this year, obviously, with Joe and Buck and Dusty, it was really impossible to go wrong. I knew Buck well. I didn't know Joe. Joe was immediately impressive. I didn't know Dusty. And you hear kind of people talk about Dusty and not, you know, old school and not, and, you know, is he advanced enough to be good? And then you always kind of wonder those things, and you meet him, you're like, oh, I get it. Like, this guy is awesome. And you can see why if you bring him in and somebody says, we're going to win a lot more games because everybody's going to love playing, like, I can see that. You know Dusty much?
I've been around him a little bit, yeah.
It's just, what a guy. So, what a great hire for Houston. And I think, I think people know what I think of Buck, but as good an in-game manager as I've ever seen. Going back to a question we were talking at the beginning about when we were good in 2012, those of us who've been at the Orioles for a while, it was hard to believe that we were going to be able to ever get past the Yankees and Red Sox. It's just the big bad teams, and Buck came in right away. I think he did an interview where he said, talking about Theo Epstein, that he's only smart because he's got so much money, and that, and he's screaming at Jeter from the dugout and telling him to stop leaning into pitches. And I don't know if he meant any of these things, but I think he just kind of gave everybody a little, like, hey, F you. Like, we're like, as good as you guys. And I think everybody noticed that. I think that's one of the things he did incredibly well. So we had a good group of candidates.
Obviously, your short-term goal in this game is to do whatever you can to help the Phillies win the World Series. Do you have any long-term goals in the game? Is it important for you someday to be a GM or run your own team?
No. I don't think so. I think in the right – I think Matt kind of said – we talked about this before. Matt had always said in the right situation it would be appealing, but otherwise it might not. And then the right situation for him, someone he really trusted in the president chair. And that's sort of how I feel. I think in the perfect spot it could be interesting. But there's something really great about the assistant GM job where you can – I can make a recommendation and say, this is what I think we should do. Good luck, Matt.
You're not the guy they're screaming about on sports radio, right?
No one hates me. So sometimes it's the best of both worlds. I always tell Matt that 28 days out of 30, it's better to be the assistant GM. he's got 2 days of 2 days a month on me. But no, I think you never know what the future holds, and that's one of the tough things about this industry is the job security is always tricky in these roles. You don't know whether you'll be here for 6 more months or for 20 more years, but I love this organization. They've been great to me. I'm really excited about what we're building. I would love to see us win a World Series here in Philly.
Ned, I appreciate your time. Thanks a lot. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you. This is great.
Many thanks to Ned Rice for taking the time to sit down for this week's episode of Executive Access. In our next episode, I'll be joined by Eric Chavez, a 6-time Gold Glove third baseman who now serves as a special assistant to Angels general manager Billy Epler. We'll discuss Chavez's playing career, what he learned from Billy Beane during his days in Oakland, his transition to the front office, how his opinion on analytics has changed since his playing days, and much more. You can search for Executive Access on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Art19, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. So be sure to subscribe and enjoy these conversations all season long. If you like what you hear, leave us a review while you're at it. We always appreciate those. And be sure to spread the word and tell all the baseball fans in your life about Executive Access. Until next time, I'm Mark Feinstein. Stay safe, everybody.